The Guardian.
Finally, Christmas is upon us, so to wrap up the season, we thought we'd bring you something just a little bit special. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer, and today we're partnering with our friends at the British Library to bring you a selection from their seasonal CD, A Literary Christmas. The readers are Simon Callow and, first off, Juliet Stevenson.
William Wordsworth. The minstrels play their Christmas tune tonight beneath my cottage eaves, while smitten by a lofty moon, the encircling laurels, thick with leaves, gave back a rich and dazzling sheen that overpowered their natural green. Through hill and valley, every breeze had sunk to rest with folded wings. Keen was the air, but could not freeze nor check the music of the strings, so stout and hardy were the band that scraped the chords with strenuous hand. And who but listened, till was paid respect to every inmate's claim, the greeting given, the music played in honour of each household name, duly pronounced with lusty call, and Merry Christmas wished to all.
Laurie Lee, from Cider with Rosie. Our first call, as usual, was the house of the squire, and we trooped nervously down his drive. For light we had candles in marmalade jars suspended on loops of string, and they threw pale gleams on the towering snowdrifts that stood on each side of the drive. A blizzard was blowing, but we were well wrapped up, with army puttees on our legs, woollen hats on our heads, and several scarves around our ears. As we approached the big house across its white, silent lawns, we too grew respectfully silent. The lake nearby was stiff and black, the waterfall frozen and still. We arranged ourselves, shuffling around the big front door, then knocked and announced the choir. A maid bore the tidings of our arrival away into the echoing distances of the house, and while we waited, we cleared our throats noisily. Then she came back, and the door was left ajar for us, and we were bidden to begin. We brought no music, the carols were in our heads. "Let's give 'em Wild Shepherds," said Jack. We began in confusion, plunging into a wreckage of keys, of different words and tempo, but we gathered our strength. He who sang loudest took the rest of us with him, and the carol took shape, if not sweetness. This huge stone house, with its ivied walls, was always a mystery to us. What were those gables, those rooms and attics, those narrow windows veiled by the cedar trees? As we sang Wild Shepherds, we craned our necks, aping into that lamplit hall which we had never entered, staring at the muskets and untenanted chairs, the great tapestries furred by dust, till suddenly, on the stairs, we saw the old squire himself, standing and listening with his head on one side. He didn't move until we'd finished. Then slowly he tottered towards us, dropped 2 coins in our box with a trembling hand, scratched his name in the book we carried, gave us each a long look with his moist, blind eyes, then turned away in silence. As though released from a spell, we took a few sedate steps, then broke into a run for the gate. We didn't stop till we were out of the grounds. Impatient at least to discover the extent of his bounty, we squatted by the cowsheds, held our lanterns over the book, and saw that he had written 2 shillings. This was quite a good start. No one of any worth in the district would dare to give us less than the squire. So with money in the box, we pushed on up the valley, pouring scorn on each other's performance. Confident now, we began to consider our quality and whether one carol was not better suited to us than another. Horace, Walt said, shouldn't sing at all. His voice was beginning to break. Horace disputed this, and there was a brief token battle. They fought as they walked, kicking up divots of snow. Then they forgot it, and Horace still sang. Steadily we worked through the length of the valley, going from house to house, visiting the lesser and the greater gentry, the farmers, the doctors, the merchants, the majors, and other exalted persons. It was freezing hard and blowing, too, yet not for a moment did we feel the cold. The snow blew in our faces, into our eyes and mouths, soaked through our puttees, got into our boots and dripped from our woollen caps. But we did not care. The collecting box grew heavier, and the list of names in the book longer and more extravagant, each trying to outdo the other.
Thomas Hardy, The Oxen. Christmas Eve and 12 of the clock. Now they are all on their knees, an elder said as we sat in a flock by the embers in hearthside ease. We pictured the meek, mild creatures where they dwelt in their strawy pen, nor did it occur to one of us there to doubt they were kneeling then. So fair a fancy few would weave in these years, yet I feel if someone said on Christmas Eve, "Come, see the oxen kneel in the lonely barton by yonder coombe our childhood used to know," I should go with him in the gloom, hoping it might be so.
John Donne. Nativity. Immensity, cloistered in thy dear womb, now leaves his well-beloved imprisonment. There he hath made himself to his intent, weak enough, now into our world to come. But oh, for thee, for him, hath then no room? Yet lay him in this stall, and from the Orient, stars and wise men will travel to prevent the effects of Herod's jealous general doom. Seest thou, my soul, with thy faith's eye, how he which fills all place, yet none holds him, doth lie? Was not his pity towards thee wondrous high, that would have need to be pitied by thee? Kiss him, and with him into Egypt go, with his kind mother, who partakes thy woe.
Anthony Trollope, from Orley Farm. It was a mile to the church, and Miss Furnival knew the advantage of appearing in her seat unfatigued and without subjection to wind, mud, or rain. "I must confess," she said, "that under all the circumstances I shall prefer your mother's company to yours." Whereupon Staveley, in the completion of his arrangements, assigned the other places in the carriage to the married ladies of the company. "But I have taken your sister Madeline's seat in the carriage," protested Sophia with great dismay.
"My sister Madeline generally walks."
"Then, of course, I shall walk with her." But when the time came, Miss Furnival did go in the carriage, whereas Miss Staveley went on foot. It so fell out, as they started, that Graham found himself walking at Miss Staveley's side, to the great disgust, no doubt, of half a dozen other aspirants for that honour. "I cannot help thinking," he said, as they stepped briskly over the crisp, white frost, "that this Christmas day of ours is a great mistake.
"Oh, Mr. Graham," she exclaimed. "You need not regard me with horror, at least not with any special horror on this occasion. But what you say is very horrid." "That, I flatter myself, seems so only because I have not yet said it. That part of our Christmas Day which is made to be in any degree sacred is by no means a mistake."
"I am glad you think that."
"Or rather, it is not a mistake in as far as it is any degree made sacred, but the peculiar conviviality of the day is so ponderous. Its roast beefiness oppresses one so thoroughly from the first moment of one's waking to the last ineffectual effort at a bit of fried pudding for supper."
"But you need not eat fried pudding for supper. Indeed, here, I'm afraid, you will not have any supper offered you at all."
"No, not to me individually, under that name. I might also manage to guard my own self under any such offers, but there is always the flavour of the sweetmeat in the air, of all the sweetmeats, edible and non-edible."
"You begrudge the children their snapdragon. That's what it all means, Mr. Graham."
"No, I deny it. Unpremeditated snapdragon is dear to my soul, and I could expend myself in blind man's buff."
"You shall, then, after dinner, for of course you know that we all dine early."
"But blind man's buff at 3, with snapdragon at 4:15, charades at 5, with wine and sweet cake at 6:30, is ponderous. And that's our mistake. The big turkey would be very good. Capital fun to see a turkey twice as big as it ought to be. But the big turkey and the mountain of beef and the pudding weighing 100 weight oppress one's spirits by their combined gravity. And then they impart a memory of indigestion, a halo, as it were, of apoplexy, even to the church services."
"I do not agree with you the least in the world."
"I ask you to answer me fairly. Is not additional eating an ordinary Englishman's ordinary idea of Christmas Day?"
"I am only an ordinary English woman, and therefore cannot say. It is not my idea."
"I believe that the ceremony, as kept by us, is perpetuated by the butchers and beer sellers, with a helping hand from the grocers. It is essentially a material festival, and I would not object to it even on that account, if it were not so grievously overdone. How the sun is moistening the frost on the ground. As we come back, the road will be quite wet."
"We shall be going home then, and it will not signify."
"Remember, Mr. Graham, I shall expect you to come forward in great strength for blind man's buff."
As he gave her the required promise, he thought that even the sports of Christmas Day would be bearable if she also were to make one of the sportsmen. And then they entered the church.
I do not know of anything more pleasant to the eye than a pretty country church decorated for Christmas Day. The effect in a city is altogether different. I will not say that churches there should not be decorated, but comparatively it is a matter of indifference. No one knows who does it. The peculiar munificence of the squire who has sacrificed his holly bushes is not appreciated. The work of the fingers that have been employed is not recognised. The efforts made for hanging the pendant wreaths to each capital have been of no special interest to any large number of the worshippers. It has been done by contract, probably, and even if well done, has none of the grace of association. But here, at Noningsby Church, the winter flowers had been cut by Madeline and the gardener, and the red berries had been grouped by her own hands. She and the vicar's wife had stood together with perilous audacity on the top of the clerk's desk while they fixed the branches beneath the cushion of the old-fashioned turret from which the sermons were preached. And all this had, of course, been talked about at the house, and some of the party had gone over to see, including Sophia Furnival, who had declared that nothing could be so delightful, though she had omitted to endanger her fingers by any participation in the work. And the children had regarded the operation as a triumph of all that was wonderful in decoration, and thus many of them had been made happy.
Rudyard Kipling, Christmas in India. Dim dawn behind the tamarisks, the sky is saffron yellow, as the women in the village grind the corn, and the parrots seek the riverside, each calling to his fellow, that the day, the staring eastern day, is born. Oh, the white dust on the highway, oh, the stenches in the byway, oh, the clammy fog that hovers o'er the earth. And at home they're making merry neath the white and scarlet berry. What part have India's exiles in their mirth? Full day behind the tamarisks, the sky is blue and staring, as the cattle crawl afield beneath the yoke, and they bear one o'er the field path who is past all hope or caring, to the ghat below the curling wreaths of smoke. Call on Rama, going slowly, as ye bear a brother lowly. Call on Rama. He may hear, perhaps, your voice. With our hymn books and our psalters, we appeal to other altars, and today we bid good Christian men rejoice. High noon behind the tamarisks, the sun is hot above us. As at home the Christmas day is breaking wan. They will drink our healths at dinner, those who tell us how they love us, and forget us till another year be gone. Oh, the toil that knows no breaking! Oh, the heimvee, ceaseless, aching! Oh, the black dividing sea and alien plain! Youth was cheap, wherefore we sold it. Gold was good, we hoped to hold it, and today we know the fullness of our gain. Grey dusk behind the tamarisks, the parrots fly together, as the sun is sinking slowly over home, and his last ray seems to mock us, shackled in a lifelong tether that drags us back, howe'er so far we roam. Hard her service, poor her payment, she in ancient tattered raiment. India, she the grim stepmother of our kind. If a year of life be lent her, if her temple's shrine we enter, the door is shut, we may not look behind. Black night behind the tamarisks, the owls begin their chorus, as the conches from the temples scream and bray. With the fruitless years behind us, and the hopeless years before us, let us honour, O my brothers, Christmas Day. Call a truce, then, to our labours. Let us feast with friends and neighbours, and be merry as the custom of our caste. For if faint and forced the laughter, and if sadness follow after, we are richer by one mocking Christmas past.
Percy Bysshe Shelley, Dirge for the Year, 1st of January, 1821. Orphan hours, the year is dead, come and sigh, come and weep. Merry hours, smile instead, for the year is but asleep. See, it smiles as it is sleeping, mocking your untimely weeping. As an earthquake rocks a corse in its coffin in the clay, so white winter, that rough nurse, rocks the death-cold year today. Solemn hours, wail aloud for your mother in her shroud. As the wild air stirs and sways the tree-swung cradle of a child, so the breath of these rude days rocks the year. Be calm and mild, trembling hours. She will arise with new love within her eyes. January grey is here, like a sexton by her grave. February bears the bier, March with grief doth howl and rave, and April weeps. But oh, ye hours, follow with May's fairest flowers.
Henry James, from English Isles. I left town a short time before Christmas and went to spend the festive season in the north, in a part of the country with which I was unacquainted. It was quite possible to absent oneself from London without a sense of sacrifice, for the charms of the capital during the last several weeks have been obscured by peculiarly vile weather. It is, of course, a very old story that London is foggy, and this simple statement raises no blush on the face of nature as we see it here. But there are fogs and fogs, and the folds of the black mantle have been, during the present winter, intolerably thick. The thickness that draws down and absorbs the smoke of the housetops causes it to hang about the streets in impenetrable density, forces it into one's eyes and down one's throat, so that one is half blinded and quite sickened. This form of the particular plague has been much more frequent than usual. Just before Christmas, too, there was a heavy snowstorm, and even a tolerably light fall of snow has London quite at its mercy. The emblem of purity is almost immediately converted into a sticky, lead-coloured mush. The cabs skulk out of sight or take up their stations before the lurid windows of a public house, which glares through the sleety darkness at the desperate wayfarer with an air of vulgar bravado. For recovery of one's nervous balance, the only course was flight. Flight to the country, and the confinement of one's vision to the large area of one of those admirable homes which at this season overflow with hospitality and good cheer. By this means, the readjustment is effectually brought about. These are conditions that you cordially appreciate. Of all the great things that the English have invented and made a part of the credit of the national character, the most perfect, the most characteristic, the one they have mastered most completely in all its details, so that it has become a compendious illustration of their social genius and their manners, is the well-appointed, well-administered, well-filled country house. The grateful stranger makes these reflections, and others besides, as he wanders about in the beautiful library of such a dwelling, of an inclement winter afternoon, just at the hour when 6 o'clock tea is impending. Such a place and such a time abound in agreeable episodes. But I suspect that the episode from which a fortnight ago I received the most ineffaceable impression was but indirectly connected with the charms of a luxurious fireside. The country I speak of was a populous manufacturing region, full of tall chimneys and of an air that is grey and gritty. A lady had made a present of a Christmas tree to the children of a workhouse, and she invited me to go with her and assist at the distribution of the toys. There was a drive through the early dusk of a very cold Christmas Eve, followed by the drawing up of a lamp-lit brougham in the snowy quadrangle of a grim-looking charitable institution. I had never been in an English workhouse before, and this one transported me with the aid of memory to the early pages of Oliver Twist. We passed through cold, bleak passages to which an odour of suet pudding, the aroma of Christmas cheer, failed to impart an air of hospitality. And then, after waiting a while in a little parlour appertaining to the superintendent, where the remainder of a dinner of by no means eleemosynary simplicity and the attitude of a gentleman asleep with a flushed face on the sofa seemed to effect a tacit exchange of references, we were ushered into a large, frigid refectory, chiefly illumined by the twinkling tapers of the Christmas tree. Here entered to us some 150 little children of charity, who had been making a copious dinner, and who brought with them an atmosphere of hunger memorably satisfied, together with other traces of the occasion upon their pinafores and their small red faces. I've said that the place reminded me of Oliver Twist, and I glanced through this little herd for an infant figure that should look as if it were cut out for romantic adventures. But they were all very prosaic little mortals. They were made of very common clay, indeed, and a certain number of them were idiotic. They filed up and received their little offerings, and then they compressed themselves into a tight infantine bunch, and, lifting up their small, hoarse voices, directed a melancholy hymn toward their benefactors. The scene was a picture I shall not forget, with its curious mixture of poetry and sordid prose, the dying wintry light in the big, bare, stale room, the beautiful Lady Bountiful standing in the twinkling glory of the Christmas tree, the little multitude of staring and wondering, yet perfectly expressionless faces.
William Makepeace Thackeray, The Mahogany Tree. Christmas is here. Winds whistle shrill, icy and chill. Little care we, little we fear, weather without, sheltered about the mahogany tree. Once on the boughs, birds of rare plume sang in its bloom. Nightbirds are we, here we carouse, singing like them, perched round the stem of the jolly old tree. Here let us sport, boys, as we sit, laughter and wit flashing so free. Life is but short, when we are gone, let them sing on round the old tree. Evenings we knew, happy as this, faces we miss, pleasant to see, kind hearts and true, gentle and just, peace to your dust, we sing round the tree. Care, like a dun, lurks at the gate, let the dog wait, happy we'll be, drink, everyone, pile up the coals, fill the red bowls round the old tree. Drain we the cup. Friend, art afraid? Spirits are laid in the Red Sea. Mantle it up, empty it yet. Let us forget round the old tree. Sorrows begone. Life and its ills, duns and their bills, bid we to flee. Come with the dawn, blue devil sprite. Leave us tonight round the old tree.
Alfred Tennyson. Ring out wild bells. Ring out wild bells to the wild sky, the flying cloud, the frosty light. The year is dying in the night. Ring out wild bells and let him die. Ring out the old, ring in the new. Ring happy bells across the snow. The year is going, let him go. Ring out the false, ring in the true. Ring out the grief that saps the mind for those that here we see no more. Ring out the feud of rich and poor. Ring in redress to all mankind. Ring out a slowly dying cause and ancient forms of party strife. Ring in the nobler modes of life with sweeter manners, purer laws. Ring out the want, the care, the sin, the faithless coldness of the times. Ring out my mournful rhymes, but ring the fuller minstrel in. Ring out false pride in place and blood, the civic slander and the spite. Ring in the love of truth and right, ring in the common love of good. Ring out old shapes of foul disease, ring out the narrowing lust of gold, ring out the thousand wars of old, ring in the thousand years of peace, ring in the valiant man and free, the larger heart, the kindlier hand, ring out the darkness of the land, ring in the Christ that is to be.
Ring out, indeed, ye bells. You can get your own copy of the British Library's A Literary Christmas from their online bookshop at www.bl.uk/shop. It exists both as a CD and as a really beautiful illustrated book. Once again, from all of us here at The Guardian and The Observer, happy Christmas and a very merry New Year.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.